All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live to the world from Jerusalem, and you're a part of it wherever you are. But right now, I'm not in Jerusalem. I am on the road, as is part of my job at the International Spokesman's Office of the Jewish Community of Hebron, the place of the mothers and the fathers. We got to go out to see the children of those mothers and fathers, and they are throughout the world. And especially, as we all know, there's a lot of Jews in the United States of America, and that's where most of my listeners are. And so that might be you. And I am right now in West Hollywood, California. And it is very, very California, with the palm trees and the sweet weather and the style of Hollywood and West Hollywood. It's a lot of fun. And this is also the place that the Jewish people have created a broadcasting empire, which is really Hollywood, which is so much of it is a Jewish invention and creation. And we're the people. We are the people. We're the producers and the directors, and so many of the studios are Jewish, and everybody knows that. And this is one of these towns that is really created by Jews, and a very successful town at that. Maybe one of the most successful broadcasting endeavors in the world. It's called Hollywood. Everybody knows about it. And yet, ironically, this place that has this California that has both Spielberg and Zuckerberg, at the very same time, there's an organization that's based here that is fighting, ironically, the weakness of the Israeli and the Jewish narrative about the land of Israel. And that organization is called Stand With Us. And as part of my tour here in the United States of America, I'm visiting also with Stand With Us. And we have with us my good friend, Ron Crudo, who is the executive director of campus affairs at Stand With Us. Ron, great to have you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Yishai. I appreciate it.
Ron, let's put it bluntly. The situation on campus is not so good. Jews are being bullied. Jews are also assimilating out of being Jewish. It's not so cool to be Jewish, and it's certainly not so cool to be pro-Israel. How do you create a situation where it is cool? Because when it's not cool, we end up losing those Jews to even anti-Israelism, and we lose a whole generation of Gentiles who would be the next generation of Americans who are generally and naturally pro-Israel, but are turning anti-Israel. How do you make Israel cool? How do you make being Jewish cool?
We've definitely lost a disconnect with this generation. Being cool and being pro-Israel just isn't in the same line. You have college students wanting to go to school and just party, meet girls, join a fraternity, join a sorority, and just have a good time. And we need to start meeting them at that level, meeting them where they feel connected to being cool. So, for example, we actually just recently did a program at a college campus in San Diego where we did an Israel Fest. And at the Israel Fest, we brought artists, we brought falafel, we brought different types of activities, things that could be appealing to students as they're just walking by and making it feel comfortable to be proactive, be pro-Israel. And we had, I think it was over 300 students go by the program, engage, get different materials, do the different tables, and they felt connected, they felt comfortable on campus being pro-Israel, and we need to mimic that kind of stuff around the country.
So that was like, it was like cool to be Jewish and pro-Israel?
In that one instance, they felt really cool.
What do you mean by when you say that it's not so cool to be pro-Jewish or pro-Israel? How does a student feel? Give me an example of that.
So, I mean, nowadays, when you bring up the Israel topic on a campus, it's just not, it doesn't connect with students anymore. And for example, I think about all the students that are at UCLA recently. We just heard about this. There was a student leader who was trying to run for a judicial board position in her student government. When she went up for the position, she was challenged on the fact that her being Jewish may influence her decision-making. I mean, you know just as much as I do, that's clear anti-Semitism. You shouldn't be asking those kind of questions for a position like that. And something like that, when that happens, she feels alienated. She feels attacked. She feels like she's in the spotlight of all this issue. And she just feels uncomfortable in the fact that she's Jewish. And this makes other students feel like they need to hide their Judaism, their pro-Israel advocacy, their pro-Israelism from other student leaders on their campus when they're running for these student positions. And that's not a place that we want our students to feel.
Right. We want them to feel that being Jewish, well, was she able to somehow say, I'm proudly Jewish, yes I am?
Oh yeah, they started questioning her and she was well aware of it. And she was well aware of the fact that it was not okay that they were asking her these questions. And she was very clear on it. And by the end of the interview, she left. She made sure she got the right representation. And we were one of those organizations who helped her combat this anti-Semitism. And ultimately, she was put on the board and she was able to make a clear statement to the university that it was not okay that her her Judaism was challenged in this type of way. And that's the type of empowerment we need to give our students. You have other universities where most students, when you go into the clubs on campus, Israel is seen as the oppressor, seen as the bad guy. And if you're a pro-Israel student and you want to get involved, let's say you're a Democrat, a liberal, wants to get involved in their college Democrats, and they openly say they're pro-Israel, automatically they're being alienated from their groups. Wow. They're not being welcomed. They don't feel comfortable.
What does that say about America?
It's a tough place to be a pro-Israel and Jewish right now. I mean,
wow.
Not all over the country. I'm not saying this is everywhere. I think that we are on an upturn for being more pro-Israel and more Jewish because we're inspiring people to feel like it's cool or feel like it's sexy. But it's not the right trend right now. It's not trendy or
speaking of
cool.
That, I heard that the swastika is cool these days.
The swastika has been coming up.
Swastika's making a comeback.
I hate to say that that's the case, but you're seeing them all over college campuses. We just had an issue at University of Massachusetts where there was multiple swastikas showing up on the campus. And you were seeing it one week and then another week and then there's two the next week. And it's just a comfortable thing to be throwing swastikas on a campus these days. And we're starting finally to have a voice behind it and having the students go to their chancellors, go to their university presidents, and speak up against it, but it has been showing up everywhere.
Wow. Is that saying something about America or is that like just a kid thing or like how serious is this business? Like
it's
swastikas are on an American campus. That's a problem.
It's a definite problem. It's saying that we haven't been doing our part, that we are behind the ball. And it's time for American Jews. I don't even think it says something about America. I think it says something to American Jews and American Israel advocates to stand up for their rights, to stand up for their respect on their campuses and around the country.
So I want to tell you a story about that, okay?
Okay.
It was about maybe like 2 years ago that I read an article that there were some Jews here in California who were organizing a group and an organization. They were season ticket holders at Dodger Stadium. And they were really upset that there was no kosher food at Dodger Stadium. And these were Orthodox season ticket holders. And they were getting together to like make a stink about the fact that there's no kosher food. Now, in response, the stadium said, but we allow you to bring any food you want. And they're like, no, you have Chinese food, you should also have kosher food. And I wrote an article saying, what is going on in your heads? Like, this is what you spend your free time doing and thinking about, that you don't have kosher food at Dodger Stadium. There are campuses in your state that people are afraid to be openly Jewish. And this is your little fight, and you're Orthodox lawyers, you're smart and serious people, and this is how you spend your time. You are not getting what's going on around here. And those people wrote to my newspaper, at the time it was the Jewish Press, and they were like, that's a disgusting article, and it's offensive. Yet they didn't dispute one fact. Do you know why? Because they took all the facts from their own press release. And I was like, this is pathetic. This is what grown men do. That's what I wrote.
You brought it to their attention.
Yeah. But that's kind of what you're talking about, which is like the Jewish community's got to wake up and realize there's like a thing here.
Yeah.
There's like a growing monster here.
We need to open our eyes. I mean, you saw it in escalation. Now, before I get into the story, that a lot of what we've been doing at Stand With Us and at a lot of our partners that we've been working with has been putting the other side from us being on the defense to us being on the offense to them being on the defense. You hear about the boycott movement all over campuses, and we've been fighting it head on. And we've been being very successful in the different issues that we've had. But because we've been doing that, people, the other side, has been taking a step further. And you saw it just now at UC Irvine. They had a film screening of Beneath the Helmet, a film about soldiers. And they had over 50 people protesting outside the classroom, banging on the doors. And there was only 15 students in the room watching this film, and they felt trapped inside the room. They couldn't even get out because of the protesters outside the room.
They felt that those protesters would go violent?
They were scared they would go violent. A young lady tried to get out of the room, and they forced her into another room, and she couldn't even leave. And that's the kind of situation. And because we weren't opening our eyes, like what you were saying, we weren't paying attention to it as a community. We weren't standing together. We weren't working together. And because of that, this is the type of escalation we're dealing with now. And
right.
We're behind the ball. We need to step the game up and start putting them even more on the defense.
Yeah. I wonder, it makes me think a little bit about the JDL in those days. Like those guys were physically like trying to like hurt us and hurt us. And like in the old days, you'd be like, yo, I'm a Jew. You don't mess with me physically. You do not mess with me. I push back on that. And we're not there right now. Like, we don't have that kind of, like, it's become also, we've become a little not physical. It's like Jews aren't tough again anymore. We're like, we've gone back to softness. And you've talked to me about that, and you've also talked to me about the problem of not only identifying with Israel, but really even identifying as being Jewish.
It's something that's being nerve-wracking. You know, I worked for Hillel for 2 years at Florida State University, and I loved working there because I was able to inspire Jewish students to want to come back to their Judaism. And I think there's this one student I remember every time I think of my days at Hillel. She was Jewish. Both of her parents were Jewish. They were great. They had a nice home. But she felt more comfortable going with her family and friends to church, not to synagogue. It wasn't where she felt connected. And it wasn't until I finally connected with her on college campuses, at my college, excuse me, and we spoke and we met, we talked often. And during that time, she reconnected. We went to Israel together. She went on Birthright with me. And through that experience, she was able to feel reinvigorated about her Judaism. But if it hadn't been for me...
Where's she today?
Today, she's actually working for a nonprofit. She's really involved. She's living in Tallahassee, and she's still involved with the Jewish community. She actually, after I left 2 years ago, was still involved in her Hillel as a student leader. And because of that involvement, because of that trip to Israel, and because of my guidance, I would say, she was able to reconnect with that Judaism. And that's not happening everywhere.
Ron, you're also the son of Israelis.
I am.
And there is a new movement here in the United States that really is trying to empower children, Israeli Americans and their children to be kind of proud about their heritage, their country. There's this other community here. There's, of course, the Russian community. There's the American Jewish community, the Russian Jewish community in America. There's also the Israeli community, and they've become a little bit more vocal and strong, especially in places like Los Angeles and Miami.
Oh, yeah.
So what's, and you deal, I see that you deal with a lot of Israelis. The Stand With Us offices are right next to a lot of Israelis, Israeli offices here. What are they like? What is it like to connect with Israelis here in the United States?
I have to say I'm proud of the Israeli-American community. I'm currently in the United States, and I have to say that they have been amazing in the recent years. We've been able to partner at Stand With Us with the Israeli-American Council. And they've been fantastic in empowering and giving a voice to the Israeli-American community, finally. And I've been able to work closely with them. On campuses, they have a group called Mishelanu. It's Israeli-American college students. When I was a student, that didn't exist. It wasn't something that I could have worked with. And with our Emerson Fellows, which is our student fellows on 80 campuses around the country, they're partnering hand-in-hand, doing programming together. And because of this Israeli-American community, we finally are able to place a real story to the Hasbara that we're trying to share. We have American students trying to say that this is Israel to them. And not all of them connect the way that we were just talking about it. A lot of them feel disconnected. They don't have like a real Israel story to what they're sharing. You bring these Israeli kids who are the children of Israelis or lived in Israel, they bring a personal narrative to everything that we do in Hasbara. And so it's been amazing being able to see that community grow up.
I think I understand what you're saying. Like, there's a certain ownership that you have to have when you're advocating for Israel. And children of Israelis or Israelis themselves, they feel it.
They do. They do. They feel it. You see it during BDS hearings. You take them into a boycott hearing. And when they tell their story, the children of Israelis, the family of their Israeli living in Israel, they share a real story. They create a personal connection, an emotional connection, which we're also trying to push out of the American students, which they all need to start placing themselves in the story of Israel and the narrative of Israel. And we're starting to get there. But these Israeli students are showing the way, and that's a real movement that we're able to utilize on campuses.
All right, give me 10 words or like word association with Chabad on campus.
Chabad on campus. It's warm. It's welcoming. It's a home away from home. It's a place to be able to relax and get away, but always feel connected to your traditions and your Judaism. I think we all come from like a Jewish home, and when we get to college, you want to just get away from it. A lot of students, not everyone, but when we do get to college, you want to get away from it. It's always nice to have that other place that you can go back to, that warm place where it feels at home and you remember your Jewish pride and your Jewish connection. And I got to say, Chabad's have been doing an amazing job at becoming a real voice on campus alongside Hillel. They're working very tirelessly to to be a voice for Jewish students and for pro-Israel students as well.
And yet how many of students on campus, on the average, you think, go into that Chabad house or the Hillel house and like choose to be outwardly associated with being pro-Israel, pro-Jewish?
It's not much. I would say out of a college campus, maybe 5%, some 10%, maybe 15% if it's a really lucky campus. But most are on the low scale, and about 5% are really getting involved. And that's a sad number when you think. I mean, when I say 10%, it's mostly people going to a religious holiday. They're not being involved. They're not connecting to their Judaism when they leave their homes. They may feel at home if they go to a Chabad, and hopefully 5% of them will stay. But most of the time, they're not as connected, and that leads back to the loss of feeling cool to be Jewish. Mm. You'd rather go out to a club than go sit at Shabbat dinner on a Friday night. Luckily, the Chabad will give you a drink here and there and give you a l'chaim, but it's not always the case. And
speaking of clubs, what about the next word association, birthright?
Birthright. So like I said, birthright for me, when with the right leaders, with the right foundation, is a very, very successful outreach to bring people closer to Israel.
Some people complain that Birthright is just a place for boys to hang out with girls and just you know, it's like a party thing. It's not very deep. They don't go to all the places in Israel. They don't get the full picture. And there's these kind of like, you know, criticisms.
Well, I'd say that a couple of those are actually selling points. Yes, they do get to hang out with girls. I can tell you I've gone into a sorority house and said, you get to either make out with an Israeli soldier, hang out on the beaches, or ride a camel in Tel Aviv, and half of them will definitely go. Uh-huh. But the reality is it's not just that. And like I said, it takes a foundation. It takes the right leaders. It takes the right content to really take Birthright to the next level. We actually partner on over 22 campuses, with 22 campuses around the country. On Birthright, it's on a program called BICEP. It's a Birthright Israel Enhancement Collaboration Project, and through that program, we actually have BICEP. The opportunity. BICEP.
Somebody must have like gone home early after they came up with that one.
So, it was a strong one. That's what I can say. I love the program though. As someone who staffed,
what does it stand again for?
The Birthright Israel Enhancement Collaboration Program.
BICEP.
And so I myself was actually an Israel. Staff for multiple Birthright buses. And I was a rakaz, I managed multiple buses. And I've seen this program take Birthright to the next level. We, as an organization, Sandwiths, go in and we become a key partner to the Hillel or the Chabad on campus. We provide them with orientation sessions. We give them enhanced programming in Israel that creates a story, helps them develop that narrative we've been talking about. And then they come back to Israel, and we have follow-up funds and support that we can offer them to ensure that these students not just come back and say to their friends,
right,
that, I had a great time.
And that's one of the critiques, the follow-up.
The follow-up, yeah. It hasn't been strong. It hasn't. Let's be honest. It hasn't been the strongest thing. But with the right Hillel or the right partners, with the right backing and the right model,
but even the right Hillel is a question mark, right? Isn't Hillel become very controversial? All kinds of stories come out, and I don't know the level of truth of it all, but like it's like they're bringing in all kinds of anti-Israel voices into it. There's something called Open Hillel. There's all these, like, I don't even know anymore what Hillel is, if not like a pro-LGBT machine. Other than that, I don't know what, and that's, of course, and that I'm saying I honestly don't know because I'm not on campus, and you know, I know that media is skewed, so I don't know, you know, if that's the, and maybe that's the next word, Hillel.
I would say that Hillel, in my experience from working there, is actually a foundation on a campus. It's like the community center of a campus.
A JCC.
It's like a JCC on a campus, right. But they provide the synagogue. They provide the kosher meals. They provide the Jewish home. I mean, my old Hillel director was like my mom away from home, you know? It's fantastic to have her there. But yes, every Hillel is individual. Every Hillel is unique. Every Hillel is working with the student leaders that they have there. In some cases, it's not the best relationship or it's not the most effective situation. But I can say that in most cases that they are an extremely successful organization on a college campus that provides Jewish students a home. And
what percentage do you think of campus goes into a Hillel?
The percentage of campus? I would say, again, the 5 to 10.
Uh-huh.
So, but it depends on the campus. I mean, you have some campuses where, like a Binghamton University, one of our best partners for a Hillel, amazing Hillel director there, Natalie. Their Hillel gets hundreds of students throughout the year. I mean, they are one of the most populated Hillels in the country. It's because of their advocacy, because of their Hillel director, because of the staff, and they know their students. And that's it takes a lot to make a really effective Hillel, but there's a lot of them out there.
All right. How about the goyim, the Gentiles, the nations, the people of this country? How are they dealing with the Israel thing? Is there Israel fatigue? Is it annoying? Do they, you know, like I sometimes wonder, like I put myself in a non-Jewish person's shoes, and I think to myself, like, why do I need to hear about this all the time? Is there a reason why we're always talking about this faraway Middle East with its annoying problems? Like, you know, I sometimes wonder, why does it all play out so much here? Like, what does it all have to do with this country? It's so far away. It took me a heck of a lot of hours to get out here by airplane. So it's like
quite a long flight.
Yeah, it's been a long travel period, and you just wonder, like, why does it play out, and what's going through the minds, do you think? And I know that you're also an advocate of not only Jewish, and we're speaking with Ron Crudo, Stand With Us, executive director of Campus Affairs, and you're an advocate also, Ron, of more engagement with Gentiles, less the cocooning and sticking together, cleaving to the Jewish only kind of safety net. What's going on in a Gentile's person mind?
It's an interesting mind, and it's one that we need to work with. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. If our Jewish students don't want to deal with the Israel issue, you think the Gentiles or the non-Jewish students want to? No, they want to go to college and have fun too. I want to say that it's probably one of the least important issues when you think of the many issues that are out there on their mind. But because it's such a big deal, and because it's happening, and because the Jewish students are being polarized on their campuses, we need our friends. We need other groups to support and work with us, other diverse groups and minority groups and Gentile groups. And it's something that we're lacking on. And it takes just taking that extra step to build that relationship and start that conversation. For example, we took a group of 15 college students, student government leaders, who are non-Jewish to Israel. And we didn't show them just a one-sided topic. We showed them both sides of the issues. We introduced them to all different types of communities. And 90% of them came back extremely Zionistic and extremely connected to the issue.
So Stand With Us took non-Jews to Israel?
Yes. Yeah, we did a Project Insight trip to Israel.
It's like a little bit like of an APAC for students.
In a sense. And we were able to take our project and take it a step further with the Hasbara on education that we do. And we were able to create a follow-through with it. And actually, one of those young men who's Colombian and was the student government president at his university is actually currently going to be starting to work for us in the near future.
And I know that two Gentiles that I've had on the show are often associated with Stand With Us. One is Chloe Valdry,
yeah,
a good friend.
Very good friend.
And also Ryan Bellarose.
Yeah, he's fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, so these are Gentiles, Black, Native American, who really identify with, and in some ways are a little bit more inspired and more clear-eyed about Israel's rights and Israel's need to stand strong. They kind of don't have the hang-ups. They don't have any Woody Allen-ness in their like personas. They're very, both of those guys.
They don't have the struggle of the Jewish community where we have a million ideas out there and we have to try to get to one. They're very committed to their concepts, and they are fantastic speakers, and we've worked with them before in the past. And they are a tool and a key to the success of being a real voice on college campuses around the country. I mean, they are true advocates, and we need to work with them. They have a very strategic voice that we can utilize on college campuses. We have Christians United for Israel, one of our best partners on college campuses when it comes to finding these different groups.
Yeah, one time I was in Albuquerque, New Mexico at the university there, and I was about to give a talk, and I see these like punky kids come into my talk at Albuquerque, and I'm like, here we go. It's going to be a rumble tonight. I'm ready. Let's go. This is it. I'm going to make the news. We're rumbling. And they take out boxes. I'm like, yeah, they got material. Let's go. I'm ready for you. Let's go. Let's take it. Here we go. And then I slyly walk past their material, and it said something like Genesis 10, I will bless those who bless thee, mm-hmm. the land of the Bible. I'm like, wait a minute. I'm like, who are you guys? They're like, we're Christians United for Israel on campus, CUFI on campus. And I'm like, that is very punk rock. That is awesome. And instead of going to the bar that night or whatever they're supposed to be doing as college kids, they were out there as like pro-Israel Christians coming to like be at my event to like defend and support what I was talking about.
And we need to stand up for them. That's amazing. Those are the kind of partners we need on campus. Our Jewish students are hanging out with other Jews. We haven't been networking with those other kids. You saw them standing there by themselves with a box. They should have been partnering on your event and making it even bigger and working together. And that, to me, is a community we need to work closer with. Not just our Christian friends.
Sometimes there's a big disconnect between those KUFI people and the assimilated secular Jewish student. The KUFI person is already like a strong Christian with a biblical belief. your average Jewish secular student is not, he's not there. So he's like, he's not turned on by that KUFI person. He's like a little weirded out by it, frankly.
We need to bring him back. I mean, we need to use Birthright as a tool to bring that.
So I know that some of my Christian listeners are going to love this next phrase, which is sometimes the Christians are a little bit more Jewish than the Jews, right?
Oh, I've heard that a few times. They usually say to me, why are you coming to me and telling me I should advocate? Why don't you get your Jews on the same side? And I got to say, we're working at that. We've been doing a pretty good job, but we're still working at it. It's definitely a truth.
Mm-hmm. So, but they are partners. KUFI are a strong partner?
A very strong partner. And there's other groups that are very strong partners that we need to work with. I remember just last week I had two of my really good friends from the Black Student Union from our university that they were staying over at my house. They came to visit me in California from Florida and they crashed in my place. And that's because I wasn't just hanging out with my pro-Israel Jewish friends. I was hanging out with other kids on campus. And we need to not only go to the Christian kids, but all the groups on campus and start making our struggles one that they can relate to, one that they can be a part of and one that they can support as well.
And what about Israel programming, Masa, going there, Like, are young people taking advantage of the educational opportunities or other opportunities in Israel? I sometimes feel like just like the religious kids all go for like a year of yeshiva in Israel, I feel like it should be like a cultural mandate that if you're Jewish, you're taking a semester abroad in Israel. Like, you're going to Tel Aviv for a semester abroad.
I mean, I would love that. I think it would be a fantastic idea.
Do such options really exist?
Oh, they do. Masa does have a great program. We actually just started a partnership with them, exclusive partnership, that we're going to be inviting them to almost all of our programs to recruit through our student leaders. And I know other groups are doing it too. And they're definitely being effective. I mean, we've seen multiple of our Emerson fellows extend and go and spend an extra year there. Actually, this one young lady who's interning in our office right now spent a year in Israel with Masa doing graphic design and video work, came back, went to her university, realized she missed it, and now she's working within our office interning with us. And that's that extra step. I mean, it takes bringing them to Israel, getting that investment to make it happen, and there's some great groups doing it out there. There really are.
That is very important stuff. All right, let's close it up by talking a little bit about lemonade.
Lemonade.
Tell me about lemonade a little bit.
Okay. Well, when life gives you lemon,
we make
lemonade, right? So we've been kind of changing up our strategy a little bit. We realized that just to go to a campus, to bring a speaker, and to walk away with just dumping facts on students isn't getting a message across. It's not getting us anywhere. Right. They're giving it facts out that are pretty much blatant lies. And we're trying to counter it with real facts, and everyone's challenging us. So what do? We have this innovative way to engage students on issues that relate to them. We brought this concept called the lemonade stand, or squeeze the challenge is what we're calling it.
Squeeze
the challenge.
Okay.
All right. So we're asking students to think of the challenges they're dealing with on campus during their finals week. And we're bringing on campus a huge lemonade stand, like one you would see like kids build on the side of the road. And we're giving out free lemonade with information cards about the struggles of Israel and the country and the people and how they took the lemons that they were dealt with over the years and created lemonade and how they can apply it to their challenges as a student, how they can use Israel's struggles to squeeze their challenges. So that, like, we made these huge lemons that they would squeeze on with like a chalkboard on it where they can write their challenges, take a picture with it, share it on social media, and then they would get the information and the facts from us as we were meeting with them. Really, really empowering. And we're taking this narrative.
So the Jews are people that overcame challenges. They squeeze the lemons. You too can be a superhero like the Jewish people.
You can be a superhero like the Jews and squeeze lemons.
Squeeze the lemons.
And you can be just as beautiful as the country of Israel. Mm. And that's what we want them to think of.
And does it work?
It works. We had we had the Hillel director tell us it was one of the most successful events he's ever had on his campus in the past 3 years.
I guess you're squeezing the lemons.
I'm squeezing lemons, and I'm making some dandy old lemonade. I mean, we're building some new strategies. We actually just had another one that recently worked really well. We brought these South African speakers to a college campus. Instead of having them go just for one event, we brought these South African student leaders. One was the national debate champion in South Africa. Another one was a student government president and a law student at his university. The reason they know each other is because one of them broke into an Israel event and protested it, and the other one talked him down to get out of the event. So it was really funny how they were touring together as black South Africans, talking about how these anti-Israel groups have hijacked their narrative. But instead of just taking them to the campus to spend an hour at a program and walk away, we had them go to the campus and meet with the president of the university, the student body president, the student senate.
These were black South Africans.
Black South Africans who were sharing their story.
Who felt the pain of apartheid.
Who felt their families had felt the pain of apartheid, and they're feeling the pain of post-apartheid South Africa.
And their narrative is being
co-opted and hijacked.
Right.
And so their whole theme was reclaiming our narrative.
Wow.
And the whole idea was that they were coming back to tell these student groups, the Black Student Union, the African Student Union, all about how these anti-Israel groups are hijacking their narrative and trying to convince them that their struggle of BDS is supposed to be theirs. And these black students are coming out there to explain to them that it was all wrong. And that actually, just as they're reclaiming their narrative, their Jewish counterparts are reclaiming their narrative too. And not just going for one event, but actually meeting and engaging and learning from these different student leaders. And I think it really made a difference. And we need to change our strategy like that.
One of the main new and old narratives that stand with us, yourself, is pushing is, in one word, indigeneity, the indigenousness of the Jewish people to the land of Israel, i.e. a historic and visceral, physical connection to the land of Israel that goes back 3,800 years, a historical bond, a historical yearning, an eviction, ethnic cleansing that happened to the Jewish people, in our yearning always to return, and then the culmination of that in Zionism, the return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel. And basically, this runs counter to the claims that we are foreigners, that we're not from this land. Mm-hmm. Indigeneity says we're really the people of this land. We're the aboriginal originals of this place.
My grandfather walked from Iraq to Israel and hid during the day to go back to his homeland. And I'm excited to be here to be a voice for him. This is our land. We're here to be a voice about our indigenous rights and our connection to it.
Ron Crudo is the director of campus affairs at Stand With Us, which means also that he's basically like a general fighting in a war, and that's the war for Jewish students on the United States campus, the other great Jewry here in the United States of America. It also means that he's fighting not only the war for their minds, but also for the minds of a generation of Americans, how they're going to perceive Israel. Are they going to be anti-Israel? Or is the America-Israel alliance going to continue? Are we going to be able, in general, in the world, to have people who understand our narrative and understand our story? That's a tremendous title that you've been given, a tremendous opportunity. And I'm sure that also comes with great challenges as well.
It definitely does.
And, of course, there's always fundraising challenges and those to understand how important it is and how outmanned we are and how behind the game we are, but how we must catch up. Ron Crudo, thank you so much for hanging out with me here in West Hollywood.
Thank you, Yishai. I'm glad you could join me here in my hometown.
All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live from Hollywood. That's right. But it's about Israel, and we're broadcasting to the world. I want to hear from you. Write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. And stay tuned, because we have more on the show today, next from the Museum of the Holocaust in Los Angeles. So stay tuned, and thanks. All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world, and you're a part of it wherever you are. Now, I'm not in my beautiful studios on the Mount of Olives, nor are we at Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov, nor are we in the biblical city of Hebron. No, I am in the other city of angels, and that is Los Angeles, California. And it's so Los Angeles out here, folks, really. It's just like what you expected it to be. It's really a lot of fun, and it has its own flavor and its own style, and I'm just getting to understand it. But ironically enough, it took me to get to Los Angeles, California, to go to a Holocaust museum. you didn't think that that's what I was going to do in L.A., but in fact, that's what I ended up doing, visiting a Holocaust museum. And you know what the truth is? I do like going to Holocaust museums, like or even quote-unquote enjoy. And that is because it gives me a kind of zap. It reminds me about the mission of the Jewish people, to survive, to thrive, to overcome evil, to share our story, to not allow people to erase our story. And generally, the human condition of having to fight evil. And today in the world, there's so many forces that are reminiscent of those dark forces of World War II that want to swallow up the world with their version of what humanity should look like and to squash down anybody who doesn't agree with them. There are certainly forces like that. And Los Angeles is also a place where you kind of show things, where you show things, you broadcast things. It's the place of media and media production. And so it's not a surprise that the Holocaust Museum of Los Angeles was indeed such a production, such a thing that showed what the Nazis wanted to hide, right? They also had their show. They wanted to show that Jews are evil. They wanted to get their people motivated to destroy the Jews. But when you asked a Nazi who was captured, what did you do? They said, I had no involvement in this. It must have been somebody else. So they did the opposite of broadcasting their truth. The Holocaust Museum of Los Angeles seeks to broadcast that. And speaking of broadcast, the way I got to the Holocaust Museum is that I connected with Randall Schoenberg, who's a lawyer, a famous lawyer. And the reason he's famous is because he was involved in recovering the property of stolen Nazi art during the Holocaust. And he won the return and basically recovered five famous Klimt paintings for his client, Maria Altman. Subsequently, a movie was made about it called Woman in Gold. And I saw that movie, was incredibly moved by the story and also by the film itself. I reached out to Randall Schoenberg and have interviewed him in the past. When I got out to L.A., I said, gosh, wouldn't it be great to see Randall? And also, it happens to be that he's got two other passions other than recovering Nazi art and being an award-winning lawyer. He's also very interested in Jewish genealogy. And complementary to that, he's also the president of the Los Angeles Museum of the Holocaust, which really he helped curate, put it together. It's his brainchild. He took it over from the same museum by the same name, but really renewed it and beautified it. And it's a great pleasure and honor to be sitting with you, Randall. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for coming out. It's great to finally meet you.
Yeah, and it was quote unquote fun to be with you in the Holocaust Museum. Is that a weird thing to say? Fun when we talk about Holocaust museums?
I mean, I think you could tell I enjoy showing people the museum. I think any time that you're presented with material that's thought-provoking and interesting, there is a certain amount of enjoyment. I mean, I think that's why people like to learn, people like to read or discover new things. So I think fun, maybe not exactly the right word, but enjoyable in the sense that you're presented with things that you didn't know about a subject that you really wanted to learn more about.
Yes. I would also add that the fact that the Nazis wanted to destroy the memory of these people and that your museum doesn't let them do that and calls them into account, but also shows the life of European Jewry, where they were, who they were, mm-hmm. puts a very human face. And I think that's maybe where your museum stands out. It puts a very human face, including a room full of screens. Mm-hmm. Where the whole, what's it called? The
Tree of Testimony at the end of the museum. We have
right.
two instances that do what you're talking about. Actually, in the first room of the museum, we have that memory pool, which is a touchscreen table filled with 8,000 pre-war photographs of Jews from Central Europe put together by the Centropa Foundation in Vienna. And you can touch the screen and bring the pictures over to the side and then read about the people. And then at the very end of the museum, we have the survivors. We have the entire Shoah Foundation database of 52,000 testimonies. That's 120,000 hours of video. If you wanted to watch it 40 hours a week, 50 weeks a year, it would take you 60 years to watch every single one of them. But what we do instead is we have a beautifully designed by our architect, Hagi Belsberg, a beautifully designed wall shaped like a tree, basically, with 70 screens. And on those 70 screens, we run continuously through the Shoah Foundation database so that every survivor testimony is shown at least once a year. And it's a beautiful visual, but it also has a lot of content. And you actually, while you were there, I think of the 70 screens, there were 20 different countries represented, 20 different languages. And you picked a couple and listened to their testimonies.
Yeah, one in Russian and one in Hebrew, and I think one in English. There was a translation from Yiddish, I think. Just to explain to people, you get to a wall, you think it might be like the news museum or something. You see this huge wall of all kinds of people talking, and there's a number next to the screen. You punch in the number on the audio the audio headset, and that screen's person is now you hear them through your ears. So you can look at this whole wall, and you look at somebody who's attractive or interesting to you for some reason, maybe their country or maybe how they look, and you're like, I want to hear this person's story. You punch in a number, suddenly they're talking to you. That's a good one.
That's a very good description of it, and I like it because I'm at the museum a lot. I was president of the museum for 10 years until this year, and I give a lot of tours. But every time I come in, it's different, right? Every time there are different faces looking at me, and sometimes I recognize people I know. We've had instances where survivors have been in the building and pointed up there and said, hey, there's my testimony. And it was completely by accident, coincidence, because we can't even control it if we wanted to. But that does happen, and it's just one of the great features of our museum. I'm very proud of it.
I found a few other things remarkable and interesting. One of them was a big model of Sobibor. And when I first looked at it, I'm thinking to myself, why do they include a model of a camp? What's so specific about this? It was a very nice model. It looked like that it was put together very, very nicely, very realistically, but I didn't understand why suddenly there was a model of one specific camp. Tell me the story about Sobibor.
Right, so in that room we have 18 screens for 18 different camps, like Auschwitz and Treblinka and Dachau and Bergen-Belsen, etc. But we have just one model, and that is from Sobibor. And that model was built by hand by a survivor named Thomas Blatt. He unfortunately passed away just 6 months ago at the end of October 2015. But he was a survivor who lived here in Southern California, actually up in Santa Barbara, about 2 hours north. And he is one of the very few survivors of that early extermination camp in Sobibor. Sobibor was very far east and was one of the initial extermination camps. And he was brought there as a teenager and made to work as a slave, basically, along with about 200 other people while they exterminated others who arrived there. And those 200 who were working as slaves decided that their time was going to come up pretty soon, so they would try to escape. And they overpowered a guard and cut through the wires, and about 200 of them tried to escape. About 100 made it through the first night, and about 50 made it through the end of the war.
They were shot.
Yeah, the Germans came after them and found them through the forest. They were hiding, and he said about half of them were killed just in that first night. About 50 made it through the end of the war, and he was one of them. And he then after the war, as a survivor, was interested in obviously in the camp where he was in Sobibor, and so he went around to all the other survivors he could find, and also camp guards like Demjanjuk and people like that. And he interviewed them to try to see if they remembered what all the buildings were in the camp, because the camp actually had been destroyed by the Nazis as the Russian army advanced. So there's nothing left of it. There's no trace of it. But he, from memory and with the help of the other survivors, put together this model of the camp so we can actually see what it looked like.
Well, why does a person do that? Why does a person, what kind of memory, something about the camp locked into his memory, and he needed to express it. He needed to bring it back out of the ashes. Why?
Yeah, well, this was the place where his family, his people were murdered, mm-hmm. right? He was just a lucky one who managed to survive it. And he, I think, believed that as one of the witnesses, he had a duty. And it's not universal. Not all of the survivors come forward and speak about it, but he's one who volunteered to testify at the war crimes trials. He's the one that wrote several books. He made the model. We have a video in the museum above the model of him speaking about his camp experience and pointing things out in the model. It's an hour and a half long. We don't edit any of it because he had this story that he really wanted to tell, needed to tell, and he thought it was necessary for people to learn. I witnessed as he came down to our museum a number of times him speaking to groups of people, to students, and telling them that this type of thing really happened, because I think part of it has to do with the fact that it was erased, right? Auschwitz, you can go and visit. It's the number one tourist attraction in Europe right now. There are 2 million people come every year. But Sobibor, there's nothing left. It's just a field and a forest. So his experience was almost erased by the Nazis, and he really wanted to make sure that people didn't forget that there were thousands of people also killed at Sobibor.
Randall, that's not the only model. There's another model that you showed me. It looked like a big dollhouse, actually. And this model was something that ostensibly didn't have to do with the Holocaust, per se. It wasn't against the Jews. It was a euthanasia center. Tell me
right.
about that.
Euthanasia is the beginning of that slippery slope. In September 1939, the Nazis invaded Poland. World War II began. In that same month, they started what they called T4, which was their euthanasia program. And they set up euthanasia centers all through Germany and Austria, which was annexed at that time. And they, in this case, it was a castle in Austria. And they brought people there who were invalids, who were mentally incapacitated, people with sort of habitual criminals, and they exterminated them. They set up the whole mechanism. They invented gas chambers. They figured out all the means that were necessary to exterminate people, and they killed, I think it's 34,000 people in that castle in Schloss Hartheim. It looks like a beautiful Renaissance castle, but it's a death center. And the amazing thing is that it was that technology and the same people who were then used 2 years later to set up the extermination camps for the Jews. Franz Stangl was the head of the Schloss Hartheim Euthanasia Center. He is then the one that goes and builds Sobibor and Treblinka and uses gas there and all the rest. So it's the reason we use that is it's a great teaching tool. Is once they went down that path, once they decided that certain people were not humans, were not entitled to live, that they could be expendable, they could be exterminated, it was much easier then for them to apply that to others, including the Jews.
So I saw those two models. I was very surprised by this story that you just told. And basically, you said the word slippery slope. There were other slippery slopes. One of them that I noticed was the book burning. And there's a quote there that whoever starts with book burning is going to end up burning bodies.
It's Heinrich Heine, who's a famous Jewish-born poet, German poet of the 19th century, and he said, "Whoever burns books will end up burning bodies." Right, and that's of course what the Germans ended up doing. They started in 1933 with these big bonfires of books from the university libraries, and before too long, they were burning people.
There's something so deep and profound about that statement. There's something, and we have to, I'm not even sure what the exact lesson is for today, but there's something that's pinging in my head telling me that you have to understand that when you want to erase knowledge, maybe very much it pains me that today things like organizations like UNESCO are trying to erase Jewish history and do it in a suit and tie informational way, but you understand that behind it, right on the heels of it, could come efforts to destroy the Jews. Speaking of efforts to destroy the Jews, Randall Schoenberg, this museum is very much... Oh, you know what? I'll get to that question in a second. One question back. I was very moved by one slide that showed that the Nazis had a numbers chart for the destruction of European Jewry with a serious and almost accurate estimate how many Jews there are in various countries and how they're going to set about to kill 11 million. Right. I was very... That kind of German didactic pre-planning just shocked me. Like, this was a... Not only did they want to kill the Jews that they caught,
right,
they wanted to get rid of them, and here were the actual numbers.
Right, so Reinhard Heydrich, who was a protege of Hitler, set up the Wannsee Conference, the famous Wannsee Conference, in a house outside of Berlin. Actually, it had been owned by a Jewish family. That house was taken over by the Nazis, and they used it to have a very short conference. I think there's a transcript of it, and it was just a matter of minutes, really, not hours. And they brought together representatives of the various Nazi organizations, and they put together a protocol, and they said, here's the problem, as they called it, right? So 11 million Jews. They counted all the Jews. They estimated 5 million in Russia and in various other places in Europe. And their goal was to exterminate all 11 million of those Jews wherever they could find them. And
wow,
that was the goal. And that's what they were trying to carry out.
I don't know. There was something very... When I saw the actual piece of paper, the kind of list, and the seriousness at which they took to really to go about undermining and destroying all the Jewish people in the world.
That's why they called it the final solution, the Endlösung, right. Which was that was their this was going to be it. This is the end of the Jewish people. That's what they were talking about.
Randall, speaking of the Jewish people as a whole, this museum is about the Jewish people. It's about the effort to destroy the Jewish people. It's about also something that's very much like your mind, a kind of didactic. Here's how many camps there were. Here's how many numbers. There's an element of it which is also kind of statistical. But one thing that I found particularly interesting as you were guiding me is that this museum has touches of your family, your specific family. And you say to me, you said to me a few times, well, there's a picture of my grandfather. There's a picture. There's you know artifacts from your family. There was keys that your grandmother had brought over. Tell us a little bit about Schoenberg and where your family comes from, because that in the movie Woman in Gold, and also in your real life, who you are so far as I know you, that plays a big role. In fact, one senses in the museum and in what I understand from you about genealogy and other things that where you come from plays very prominently in your life, and I wanted you to tell us a little bit about that.
Well,
am I right about?
I have to start by saying that I didn't invent Los Angeles Museum of the Holocaust. It's an over 50-year-old museum. It's probably the second oldest in the world after Yad Vashem, certainly the oldest in the United States, and it has a large collection of a variety of materials that you saw that are really just sort of unique and that you can't see anywhere else. And all I did 5 years ago was, thanks to the success I had with recovering the Klimt paintings, was I helped them build a new museum, new building in Pan Pacific Park here in West Los Angeles. And so while we were putting together the new museum, I was in charge of also curating the new exhibit, and where I thought I might be able to add something from my own family's collection to spice things up, that I did. So you saw my grandmother's keys that she kept. She escaped the day after Kristallnacht from Vienna. And she had, like all of us, we have that drawer full of keys that we won't throw away because we're not quite sure what they fit to, right? So she had all these skeleton keys. So I thought, okay, that's evocative of this world before the Nazis, and that's that first room. So I put that in there. And their old Haggadahs that the family used and things like that. So wherever
Remind
I thought...
Remind us who they were, though. Remind us
yeah,
about your grandfather.
The keys were my mother's parents, the Zeisels, Eric and Trude Zeisel, who were from Vienna. And as I said, they managed to escape the day after Kristallnacht from Vienna. My grandfather, Eric Zeisel, was a composer. His main claim to fame is his work, the Requiem Hebraico, which is a Hebrew requiem composed just at the end of the war, which is probably the earliest piece of Holocaust commemoration. I was very lucky to go to Israel and hear Zubin Mehta and the Israel Philharmonic perform it a few years ago, which was a great treat. On my father's side, though, I have a more famous composer, Arnold Schoenberg, and my grandmother, Gertrude Schoenberg. They also came from Vienna, but they were living in Berlin in late 1920s into the early 30s. And so when Hitler came into power in 1933, my grandparents fled almost immediately. It was actually in May of 1933, and they got a telegram from my grandmother's brother, violinist Rudolf Kolisch, and the telegram said, change of air urgently recommended. And they
change
went...
Change of air?
Change of air. That was the code word for them. Change of air recommended. And they left that night on the night train from Berlin to Paris and never went back. They had their stuff was then sent after them. But they really fled immediately and went to Paris and then came to the United States already at the end of 1933. They were in the United States and in Los Angeles in 1934. So my grandparents on my father's side got out very early. I showed you one of the things we have in the museum that I always like to show people is we have a facsimile of an article that my grandfather put together, this is Schoenberg, put together in October 1938, where it's a very long essay that he wrote about what was happening to the Jews in Europe and what needed to happen to rescue them. And it starts off with another list, like the Wannsee list, a list of the Jews, not just in Germany and Austria, which is where the Germans were at that point, but also Poland and Romania and all the Hungary and all the other countries in Europe. And he lists those countries and he says, is there room in the world for 7 million people? Are they condemned to doomed? Will they be famished, butchered, right? He uses the term butchered with 7 million people and then two paragraphs below, he says, is there a place in the world for 500,000 people who must migrate or die? Now, this is before Kristallnacht, a few weeks before. And it really is the earliest prediction of the Holocaust. I've asked all the experts, and they most of them don't know what to do with it, because many of them think that the Nazis only decided in 1941 to kill everybody, but the writing was clearly on the wall. And, you know, people say the Holocaust is unimaginable, but of course the Nazis had to imagine it to do it, and it was possible for other people to imagine too. And I always like to ask people, it's not really answerable, but what was it about my grandfather, Arnold Schoenberg, that allowed him to see what was coming, when for so many people in Poland and elsewhere, the Holocaust came like a tidal wave? They woke up one morning and by the evening they were dead. Whereas my grandfather really saw it coming. And why was that? Was it that he had this incredible fantasy, that he was this artist with his finger on the pulse? Was it that he had grown up in Austria and lived in Austria and Germany as Hitler was coming into power, so he really witnessed pretty much firsthand the rise of the Nazis? Or was it also that he had left and had that outsider's perspective? And I think it's probably, in my view, a combination of all three of those things. But I think it's so interesting. You know, there's so many people who try to predict the future, and how do you know who to listen to, right? It's a hard question. And I think it's interesting to look at someone who accurately predicted the Holocaust and figure out, well, what was it that he saw? What were the signs that he saw? But you can imagine, I also think about how unbelievably sad that must have been for him to watch that actually happen and be powerless to stop it. It just seems unbearable to me to have predicted that and then to see it have happened exactly as he saw it.
One of the things that people talk about Randall Schoenberg is the efficacy of these Holocaust museums. And just a kind of question of like, what are we trying to achieve with this? And as you said, as you were talking just now about how painful it must have been for him to actually see the fulfillment of his terrible vision. One also wonders about our current time, and your museum goes out of its way to also not equate, but to highlight other Holocausts. If it's the Armenian Holocaust,
other genocides,
genocides.
I would say we do in a couple spots we do sort of an opportunity, because it's a teacher's museum, it's an educating museum. And that one of those things that I learned in grade school and high school is compare and contrast. So when we talk about the ghettos, we also talk about a little bit the Japanese internment camps in California, which are different, but not completely different. And the same thing with the genocide. So right when we talk about the genocide, we have that Sobibor model. Next to it, we show also some panels on the word genocide, which was invented by Raphael Lemkin, a Polish Jewish refugee from Nazism, who invented the word genocide, speaking about what was happening to his family. And we talk about four other instances of genocide, Armenians, certainly, Rwanda, Darfur, in Cambodia. And there are obviously differences, but there are similarities in the scale. And yet I like to point out to people when I walk people through that if you take the high estimates of those four other major genocides of the 20th century and you total those high estimates up, the figure is still 2 million less than the number of Jews killed in the Holocaust. So the Holocaust is really an order of magnitude larger, but it is that same phenomenon that has happened in the past, and unfortunately we have to still be vigilant and prevent it from happening in the future.
And speaking of that, let's try to finish off on a positive note. Again, I'm going to be a little bit tongue-in-cheek here, but I'm going to ask you, Babi Yar, horrific murder of Jews chucked into a ravine not far from Kiev. How did you tell me to take heart from Babi Yar?
Well, when we get to that very difficult section of the museum, when I'm with Israeli visitors, I'm constantly trying to find ways of explaining to people the scope of the Holocaust, because it's really why we talk about it. You know, there are lots of tragedies in the world. Every family has individual tragedies, but it's this collective tragedy of the Jewish people that is so enormous. So how do you get people to approach the numbers? So Baba Yar, you're right, is a ravine outside of Kiev, and in one weekend, the Nazis brought over 30,000 people there and executed them in that ravine. And I always ask Israelis, I said, where do you think more Jews were killed in all of the wars and terrorist attacks in the history of the State of Israel from 1947 to the present, the ones you remember on Yom HaZikaron, right? Or in a weekend outside of Kiev and Baba Yar, right? And the answer is Baba Yar, by a lot. It's almost 10,000 more Jews killed in Baba Yar than in all the history of the State of Israel. And I think that, at least for Israelis, I use that just to give you a little bit of the scale, of the magnitude. You know, we think of Israel constantly under attack, constantly at war, constantly suffering, and yet many, many more Jews, 50% more so far, were killed just outside of Kiev in that one massacre, which is just one. It's one of the largest, but it's just one of many that occurred in all throughout Europe. Under the Nazis. So I that's what I do to try to help Israelis really approach this subject of the magnitude of the Holocaust.
Well, Randy, I think that we'll finish up our interview now. I want to thank you so much. I think that you come from musicians, from famous composers, and this Holocaust Museum is also kind of your composition. It's trying to put the whole thing into a kind of music, and that music shouldn't, I don't want to be cliche here, but that the music shouldn't be drowned out. It shouldn't be turned off. It should be heard. And I came out of the museum in some form empowered, positive, about Jewish, the beautiful culture that existed. And at the end, there were also, you had a brand new display of Sefer Torahs that were all gathered from destroyed Jewish communities in Prague. But those Torahs were dispersed amongst different communities in the modern era, and they came back, many of them, to the museum, and beautiful inscriptions. And one of them was I like small things. I like small books. You know, I'm into small books. And there was a small Sefer Torah there, and it was in its own little ark, and it had a beautiful inscription that said Ki Mitzion Tetzeh Torah Udvar Hashem Yerushalayim. The word of God will come from Zion. And the sayings of God will come from Jerusalem. It gave me a lot of heart, and I thought it was a beautiful museum, and you brought honor to certainly the Schoenbergs, the Jewish people, and dishonor to those people who tried to destroy us. And we shall be vigilant. We shall indeed be vigilant. At the same time, your grandfather's prediction of the Holocaust should be also seen as that sometimes you should pay attention when people are talking, and there are dangers out there, and the Jewish people simply don't have the leisure to not pay attention to those things. We have to be strong, we have to be vigilant. And the other thing that you're vigilant about is finding our Jewish trees. And let's just finish off with that. You told me that 6 million Jews had been erased from our trees, and it's our job to bring that music back up, to bring their names back up. Let's finish up with that. What's the thought?
Yeah, I'm a fanatical genealogist. I was in Jerusalem last year for the annual international conference. This year it's in Seattle. I work on a program called Genie.com, G-E-N-I.com. I don't own it. I just work on it. It's actually owned by MyHeritage, which is an Israeli company. But I love it. And not just me, but thousands of people like me are basically rebuilding the family tree of the world. And many of us are Jews, and we are very actively repopulating basically our family trees. So many of us don't know where we came from. We don't know what happened to our families. And there are people like me who really enjoy, every day I do it, it's like a crossword puzzle, helping people figure out their family trees, adding branches, adding people that they couldn't find on their own. There's something called the Jewish Genealogy Portal, which I started up on Facebook. It has 18,000 members, and people post questions up there. Someone said, you know, my name Gladzer, I don't know where it comes from. And within a few minutes, people had brought him back to the early 1800s. It's that type of thing that we're doing also on Genie, and it's really my passion. I said to you earlier that the 6 million leaves on our family tree were eliminated, were incinerated, and if we, those of us who are capable today, are able to sort of put them back and preserve them, by adding them to our family trees. I think that's our duty, and that's how I feel. And there are many people like me, and fortunately, we're doing a pretty good job so far.
All right, Randy Schoenberg, I'm going to do it, okay?
I came. You have to. I promise.
Yeah, that's it. I came from, I called this tour from Hebron to Hollywood, and Hebron is where the original parents of the Jewish people are buried, and I had to come all the way to Hollywood to be remembered that we have to get the leaves back on the tree of the 6 million. Randy Schoenberg, award-winning attorney, recoverer of the Klimt paintings from the Austrian government. A great movie was made about that story, Woman in Gold, which is, I promise you, it's a must. That website for the genealogy is?
Genie.com, G-E-N-I.com, or look up the Jewish Genealogy Portal.
And the L.A. Museum?
L.A. Museum of the Holocaust is lamoth.org. So L-A-M-O-T-H, L.A. Museum of the Holocaust.org.
All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show. Write me an email if you have any questions for Randy. Write them to me, yishai@thelandofisrael.com, and I'm happy to forward it. If you need some genealogy help, push him on it. He'll help you reconnect to who you are. And he says, it's like this, we're all one family. Give me, what did you say? Give me.
I said, just build your tree. By the end of the day, we'll be connected.
Right, by the end of, that's it. By the end of the day, we'll be connected. And you are connected to the land of Israel, to the story of the Jewish people, and to the great vision of a light onto the nations. When you're listening to this show and listening to this network, stay tuned, folks. Randy, thanks so much.
Thank you. I'm really happy to do it.
God bless you, folks, from Los Angeles, and shalom.
Rabbi Isaac Nissenbaum, one of the founders of the religious Zionist Mizrahi movement, wrote, "The objective of Mizrahi is the total revival of our nation in all its aspects, to revive Judaism in our hearts and to revive our hearts for Judaism, to revive the land for the nation and to revive the nation on the abundance of the land. The objective of Mizrahi is the total revival of Judaism in all its aspects through its depth, width, and height. It is a Judaism whose legislators redeem, whose farmers are prophets, whose businessmen are sages. It is a Judaism which creates spiritual and physical values, synthesizing them into one unit, destroying the houses of bondage and building its huts of freedom." The Land of Israel Network is powered by the Mizrahi World Movement.
When I was growing up, I would read the books in the second half of the Old Testament, and sometimes I would get a little bit lost in all those prophecies of Jeremiah, Isaiah, and so on. That all changed the day I stepped foot in the land of Israel. As I harvested grapes and olives and more on the mountains of Samaria, the words of the prophets came to life right before my very eyes. Today, you could be a part of this phenomena too. I am Caleb Waller, and I'm inviting you to step into the pages of prophecy by joining us in Israel. Go to our website, that is hayovel.com. H-A-Y-O-V-E-L.com to connect to this amazing opportunity.